Oh, that people sometimes immediately say I'm not white. Yes, it usually manifests in a, well, I'm just a human race. So one of the techniques I use to open my sessions is I talk about my own race immediately, right? Draw people's attention to my race. And then ask them to go around the group and to say what their racial identity is. And immediately it puts white people out of our racial comfort because we are rarely ever asked to identify our race. And we certainly have never been taught that it's relevant or has any meaning. So here I am.
Why does that matter, this idea that we don't get asked about our race?
Because what it reinforces is that we are just universal people. We're just universal human beings. Right. And that other people have a race. Somebody has a race, but not me. And so when we're always putting, you know, a racial qualifier in front of a person of color, the black director, the Asian reporter, then we reinforce this idea of that we're individuals, but they're always members of their group. So the right to be seen as an individual actually becomes a privilege because not everybody is granted that.
If a group member doesn't identify as white, what do they say they are?
Oh, they will say human. Sometimes you preempt that by saying, okay, just a quick check. Do we have any cyborgs in the room? No, no robots. We're all okay. So we're all human. All right. So we can just establish that. Now, what is your racial identity? So depending on my mood, I might preempt that move. They may also say I'm European, American, or I'm Italian, or I'm Irish.
What's wrong with that if they're a Italian-American.
Well, there's nothing wrong with it. I'm Italian-American. But we are talking about race, and we live in a society in which race matters profoundly. And I don't move through the world having an Italian experience in the U.S. I have a white experience in the U.S., and we have to get honest about it and grapple with what that means. And oftentimes, people who say, oh, well, I'm Irish, really, let's face it, they're Irish on St. Patrick's Day. But that's not actually the identity they kind of lead their movement through the world from.
Why does it matter that they don't go through life as Italians in this world? What's important about that?
Well, it matters because let's talk about the melting pot for a moment. So I was raised to see, oh, the great melting pot. The U.S. was this great melting pot where everybody came and melted. But the reality is only European ethnics melted. So, yes, Italians and Irish were once seen as similar to black. Right. No Italians allowed. No Jews. No Irish.
Don't bother applying for a job.
Right. But once you assimilate, drop your accent, maybe modify your food a little bit, you meld into whiteness, quite frankly. And it was the reward for dropping that ethnic identity and getting to become white. People of color were never able to melt into that pot and only be seen as individuals or as members of a really specific ethnic group. They're always seen in racialized terms. Eduardo Bonilla Silva is a sociologist who writes about race, and he says people of color could never melt into the pot. They could be used as the wood to fire the pot. And I love that. What he's implying is that in order for me to be white, somebody has to not be white. And so in so many ways, my identity depends on the presence of people of color.
Well, isn't that then a reason not to call each other white? If I say I'm white, it's like, oh, I'm no color at all, and you're the colored people. What's helpful about that? We all have a different skin tone.
Right. Well, first, it's much, much deeper than our skin tone, right? So it's really kind of how we're socialized to see ourselves. It's the way that we engage around race, what we see, what we don't see, what we're invested in, what society grants us. So even though we talk about it as just skin color, it's much, much deeper than that in terms of the ways that we're socialized. But we don't live in a world in which race doesn't matter. And so to pretend that we're in that world actually just hides and obscures how it matters. And unfortunately, that benefits those that are privileged by the way race matters. So it serves me to carry on as if it has no meaning, because then I don't have to grapple with the ways my race advantages me.
Help me understand how this plays out in my own home, Robin. I really don't talk about white and black with my kids. We might talk about, if it comes up, darker skin or lighter skin, and they know about Martin Luther King. It's very simplified, but I don't want to set them up to think of human beings as being opposites. Like black, you're black, I'm white.
Well,
what's wrong with that?
Sadly, they learn very early that human beings are set up as opposites. So think about boys and girls. Do you think any child doesn't know that boys and girls are very different, that it's very, very important which one they are, and that they not be confused? And a lot of what you, I hope, would do as a parent would be help them challenge those boxes. But to pretend as if the boxes aren't there is not going to help your child. So race matters. And children by age 3 or 4, there's lots of great research on this, by age 3 or 4, they know how it matters. And to put it really bluntly, they know that it's better to be white. And unfortunately, when we pretend like that's not happening, we leave them at the effect of that message with no coping skills to resist it. So they internalize it, but they also learn to deny it. We need to be real about what's going on in the world. I'm sure there are lots of the issues you would address. I would like to think you would talk about domestic violence. And if you had a daughter in particular, right, you would teach her that she should never or never has to endure certain kinds of treatments. And if you had a son, you would want to make sure he understood that he's not free to just proceed with girls any way he wants, right? We know that we have to help them with this. And when it comes to race, we just want to pretend that nothing's happening and that the best way to address it is to ignore it.
How about a middle ground where I really do talk to my oldest about privilege and skin color? I just haven't put it in black-white terms. That seems to be a relic that it would be nice if we got past this. First of all, the kids know that somebody isn't black and they're not white literally, but also I don't want to set them up to think of people, as I say, as opposites. How do I play that middle ground?
Yeah, it's very, very challenging, right? And if we had, you know, figured it out, we'd be somewhere else.
Yeah.
But I just have to reiterate that not addressing it is not the way they're going to kind of understand that nothing's happening. You also have to ask yourself, from what racial position are you proceeding as a parent, right? And it's worth reflecting on, who does it serve to want to proceed as if these things don't matter? Do you think that tends to be what parents of color say or think?
No, that they're, I don't think
right.
that.
So that there's something in there for us. There's a little red flag. Wait a minute. This is probably not a universal sentiment. It is probably most particularly a white sentiment, and therefore it's functioning in a way that I should look at and grapple with, right? When I'm trying to figure out how something works, or it's very hard to ever get to true or false or right or wrong or good or bad. And so I ask how it functions. Who's most likely to say that and what does it serve? So human nature is a common argument I hear. It's just human nature. Someone has to be on top. Right?
Oh.
And I suppose if you look across the recorded history, it certainly appears that there have always been those who dominate. And yet, who is most likely to say that domination is just human nature? Those on the top or those on the bottom? It is rarely a narrative of those on the bottom. And if we also look across recorded history, we can see that striving for justice and overcoming domination is just as old.
It's also human nature.
Exactly. So what side do I want to be on that, right? And who does it serve, right? Which narrative serves what? So this idea that the best way to have our children be, you know, so-called open-minded is to not talk about race as if it mattered, really just serves those of us who have been able to proceed as if it doesn't matter.
Will you give me an example of how white people acting like despite what's happened over hundreds and thousands of years, suddenly race doesn't matter. How that functions to perpetuate racism? How does that work?
Well, one of the challenges is that we are not able to trace our history into the present. So one, we actually aren't taught really good, clear history. I mean, there were hundreds of years of our history was founded in human enslavement. To not grapple with that as deeply and complexly as we discuss lots of other Declaration of Independence, you know, all of these things that we study, does not prepare us to understand how we came to be in the moment we're at. But we also have to be able to trace it into the present. So there's this disconnect. One, we don't even know our history, but two, we see all of this as in the past. It serves us not to look at how race has shaped our lives. It serves us not to look at how we've been advantaged by our race. To have to look at that challenges our very identities as good people. And that's been one of the most effective adaptations of racism post-civil rights, is to make being a good moral person and complicity with racism mutually exclusive. So that what I hear, if you suggest that I'm complicit with racism or that I'm gaining advantage by nothing that I'm aware I'm doing, you've basically given me a deep moral insult by suggesting I'm not a good person. And since I'm consciously against racism and unaware of these advantages, I'm going to put all my energy into defending my character. And we can see this everywhere. It's what I call white fragility, right? This incredible...
You actually coined that now famous phrase, white fragility.
Yeah. You see this incredible defensiveness and this need to deflect and deny and explain away everything but the deep lifelong reflection that we need to be doing in a society that is so separate and unequal. And that's the other piece. You're talking about your children, but odds are you probably are raising them in segregation, as most white people raise their children in segregation. So we tell them that everyone's equal, but we don't live our lives as if that's actually the truth. Right, we don't live our lives together. We don't seek out to build those relationships across race. And the fundamental message is that there isn't really any value in doing that. Those are the deeper messages our children are getting.
So, Robin, what happens when someone listening to you right now stops saying, "I'm Irish, half Irish, half Scotch," or "I'm part of the human race"? What happens when someone listening to you now says, "I am white"? Why does that matter? What happens next?
What happens next, hopefully, is they begin to grapple with what that means, because it does shape every aspect of their lives and their perspectives. It shapes how we come to the table. The reality is, because of institutionalized structured racism, white people control all the institutions. We sit at the tables of power. We make the decisions that are going to affect other people's lives. And those other people don't tend to be at those tables. And so if we cannot grapple with what perspective we're bringing to those decisions, right, if we don't even notice that alternative perspectives are missing, or the people who will be affected by those decisions are not at the table, we're going to keep reproducing the outcomes that serve our interest and our narrow worldview. What I would hope is the person would begin to grapple with what it means and how it shapes their relationships, and also the relationships they don't have. If we look, take a hard look, most of us don't have authentic, sustained cross-racial relationships. We don't understand people of color's experiences, and yet we get to be in the position to represent them, right? These are very weighty outcomes, right? There's an activist, Pat Parker, and she puts it like this. "First of all, forget that I'm black." All right? And I think what she means by that is stop reducing me to that. Stop having everything be about that. Stop always labeling me that way. And second, don't you ever forget that I'm black and that I have a different experience than you do, and a different worldview and a different reality. And that's that tension, right, that balance of not reducing but never forgetting, or not pretending that none of this matters, right? It's that balance. And again, if this was easy, I think we'd be in a different place than we are. But it does require the willingness to be uncomfortable and to not know, and to be in that place of racial humility. This is one of the greatest challenges for white people. We don't have a lot of humility on this topic. We live our lives so separately. We don't really understand our histories except in the most superficial ways. And yet we all have opinions that we so arrogantly just trot forth as if they're as valid as anybody else's.
Do you think when I feel uncomfortable saying I'm white, you know, some part of me immediately wants to make a joke out of it or be sarcastic about it. Do you think there's, you know, and I feel I want to get beyond these labels. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's something either unconscious or dishonest with me that's going on?
Well, it goes against all your conditioning, right? You have had that deep access to a sense of yourself as an individual, as special and unique, right? And to say that being white means something, you have to give up a little bit of that individualism. And it's also an ideology that's rather sacred, right? It's like, you know, it's a terrible breach for you to suggest, you know, you're generalizing, that's wrong. So there are all of these beliefs that make it really hard for you to do that, right? So you have to give up a little bit of that. You have to proceed as if it actually matters that you're male, right? That you're, you know, all of these able-bodied, that you're white, and that they shape the way you experience the world. And it wasn't just your special hard work that, you know, you're swimming in the current, and the current moves you along so that, yes, you work hard and it pays off in a particular way, a way that we can clearly predict and measure that it's most likely going to pay off.
It's going to work out for me.
Yeah.
Boy.
Yeah.
You tossed off the observation that you probably live in segregation, but there's a bunch of our listeners who live in, hey, I'm in a really diverse zip code. I don't live in segregation. That's not me. What do you say to that?
Oh, well, almost any diverse zip code that a white person lives in is no longer going to be a diverse zip code soon. And on some level, we know that, which is why we're there. Yes, living in...
Well, that's interesting. So you're there to be part of that changing diverse zip code.
You know it's coming up and you got in at a good time. It's probably less expensive than other neighborhoods. But
ouch.
Well, yeah. So living in a diverse environment is certainly, I think, offers opportunities that you don't have when you don't live in a diverse environment. But that doesn't mean we're actually living an integrated life. And that's one of the common patterns when whites come into formerly people of color neighborhoods and gentrify them. They don't patronize the small businesses owned by people of color. They don't get involved in local community events, and they don't send their children to those schools, right? And so they actually don't integrate. It's like an image I show when I'm doing my presentations of all of these very hugely popular, famous shows about ideal friendship that many of us grew up with across the decades. Seinfeld, Sex in the City, Friends, Gossip Girl, Girls. Every one of those shows takes place in New York City, and every one of them is a completely white friendship circle.
It's a surprisingly lily white place, Manhattan.
Right. So even in the midst of diversity, always the message coming at us is there's no inherent value in an integrated life, that the ideal world, the world that we call good. Notice the power of that message. To call a segregated neighborhood, which is what most of us live in, good and sheltered. That there's a message there, right? Why would we see it as good if it's segregated? Why was it a tragedy to have segregation imposed on blacks in the Jim Crow South, but it's something to be celebrated in our lives?
All right, Robin, how about this? Is it okay to look forward to the day when race doesn't matter and I don't identify as white?
Yes, but we are not there yet. And to proceed as if we are only obscures what's actually going on and holds it all in place, right? And we will not get to that place without action, without you and I actually interrupting the patterns of this in our own lives, right? So to just be aware of things like white privilege and white advantage and be able to say, oh, yeah, I know I have it, and then proceed the way you've always proceeded, that will not change the way the system is. We actually have to look at the really deep issues, like how do we fund schools and the criminal justice system. And, you know, there's so much work to be done.
You've told me, Robin, that a real common question you get is, hey, aren't we, by dividing into races, I'm white, this person's that, we are dividing ourselves. That's a bad thing, right?
That's another just classic white narrative, right? We live divided lives. Right. I think most of your listeners, if they really look at who's at your table, and I don't mean setting your table, I mean sitting at your table, breaking bread with you, who is in your life, where are those close, intimate relationships, we're already separate by race. So to not talk about that only holds it in place. And what other social dilemma do we think the best strategy for would be to never discuss? Domestic violence? Child abuse is the best strategy to never discuss these things. You know, when you're on the airplane and they say, you need to put your oxygen mask on first and then turn and put it on others. That's what I would say to parents, right? We always want to, you know, how do I teach my children as if we're in good shape and we just have to then like say the right thing to them. But where are we? Do we have our oxygen masks on? What work have we done? What deep soul searching? How have we set up our lives? Who's in our children's world?
Is this especially a problem in Seattle? White people who don't want to deal?
No, I used to teach in Massachusetts.
But I've heard that said about Seattle.
Well, what Seattleites are able to do, white Seattleites are able to say, gosh, there just aren't very many here. So we can cover it that way. When I was back east, the segregation is so explicit. I mean, you have cities that are 57% black and Latino, and block by block, you have either all white or all black and brown. So it's harder to deny on the East Coast, right? But Seattle, we have...
So we're better off in Seattle. We're advanced.
No, we have a very deep history. There's lots going on here. We have lots of opportunities to challenge this segregation. There's your other red flag. Whenever you feel complacent as a white person, you should think, okay, what about this narrative is making me feel better about myself and therefore less responsible to have to do anything to interrupt it? We have plenty of opportunities in Seattle to interrupt racial segregation. Seattle public schools are under federal investigation right now for racial disparity. This does translate into people's lives, right? This lack of understanding of the reality of people of color, combined with deep implicit bias that no white person can miss because the images circulate around us 24/7, it does translate into how we go forth and do business. So no, Seattle is not off the hook. In fact, I think white liberals are the most challenging because the degree to which we think we're good to go because we're open-minded and we shop at PCC and, you know, we bring our own bags and we're going to spend all of our time trying to convince other people of that and not any time doing what we need to be doing for the rest of our lives, which is deep, deep soul searching and active interruption of the patterns that keep us complicit.